This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin, and with me, Julian Ng and Ibrahim Sani, and welcome to The Morning Run.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
And to a new week.
Happy Monday, everyone.
Happy Monday. I think it's oxymoron for some.
Well,
you know?
Yeah.
Because Monday is the start of work, you know, people don't always kind of look
forward
to that.
Somebody once told me that the four letters that will never be seen together is TGIM. So, yeah, I don't know how true that is.
Yeah, that's probably true. We have an exciting lineup for you this morning on the 10th of October as we celebrate World Mental Health Day. Now, I'm not trying to say that all that we're doing this morning is related to World Mental Health Day, but I guess to the extent that even business and the economy affects your mental health, just because, you know, people lose jobs or people have their aspirations squashed, it affects your mental health. I mean, do you guys... when you think of mental health as a term, do you think only of, you know, people with suffering from some serious psychosis, or would you include things like, you know, kind of everyday anxieties and stress in that mental health?
The latter, I think, because I think we've come to a stage where mental health involves things that don't relate to insanity, right? If you have chronic anxieties, if you're worried about other things, and if you're depressed, lonely, that's, I think, all a part of mental health, isn't it?
Absolutely, because there are two kinds of mental health, right? Organic and inorganic. Organic means that it comes from within the body because of chemicals, but inorganic, that's where all these things come in: the anxiety, the depression, the inability to fit in a society, and all that does contribute something negative towards your mental health.
Okay, so what about your investment in your own personal mental health? I mean, you probably do spend money going to the GP to get, you know, to deal with aches and pains and flus and stuff. But would you spend money on seeing a counselor, for instance, if you had anxiety, whether it was chronic or severe, you didn't quite know, would you actually go to a mental health expert for help?
I don't know. I think a lot of people don't formalize that process, thinking about what they should do about their mental health. A lot of people just amble along and go through with it. But I guess the best cure is that you got to love yourself, man. That's free, right?
Well, yeah, but you know, people don't know how to love themselves. And when you get all tied up in knots emotionally and psychologically, you probably won't be able to help yourself out of the situation. It's like anything else, right? Sometimes you just need that extra help of somebody who's trained to help you to get you through it. I mean, Ryan, would you go and see a mental health expert?
Absolutely. People take care of their physical well-being a lot more.
Don't you live with one?
Yes.
No, you live with a doctor. She's a respiratory expert, is it?
No. She's a psychiatrist. Oh, she's going to be a psychiatrist very soon. And
we're talking about Ibrahim's wife, by the way.
Yeah,
who's
talking about
just outside the studio.
Absolutely.
Maybe she should come in and say a word or two.
The thing is, right, I don't know whether talking to her would add to the anxiety or would actually solve it. Because
that's,
you know,
not nice.
At the end of the day, I'm still talking to my wife, so it does add that.
But and sometimes you need somebody. I mean, I must admit, I confess, I've been to a counselor.
Yeah.
And when I was having anxiety, and it was the best thing in my life, and I think having somebody sit with you and work with you through your own mental processes was very healthy. In fact, I recommend it to a lot of my friends. I say, look, you know, perhaps as a friend, I can only do so much. You might benefit from seeing somebody and seeing professional help. And I think there's absolutely no shame in going to see a mental health expert for your problems.
Absolutely. I fully agree with that. I think there is an arbiter role in a counselor or a psychologist or, at the end of the day, a psychiatrist to actually help you out with your woes.
Yeah, I think so too. I agree. And I think one way that really helps, at least from a personal experience, is that you got to generalize your thoughts. And once you do that, it's also like talking to somebody. You got to be completely honest about what you're writing and open up to yourself, right? And that's therapy as well, I guess. And, you know, the other thing is that this is very much a pill prescribing world, right? Every time you go and see someone, you get a prescription for a bunch of pills. And I think that we are living in a world today where some of the other non-pill solutions are just understated, you know, just going out there for a walk or a run, being with people and friends.
Absolutely. And I think that's probably very healthy. They say exercise is very good for any form of mild depression, you know. But the problem is when you're depressed, you're unlikely to avail yourself of all those things. It's precisely that you end up cutting yourself off from people, not engaging in healthy activities. Precisely because you have a problem, and so you need a kind of. And we're going to put out a poll on how many of you would invest time and money in your mental health, and you know, see what we come up with later on. Now, later on, after the 8 o'clock news, we have the Breakfast Grill, and we have Professor Aslam Hanif. He's the director for the Center for Islamic Economics at the International Islamic University of Malaysia, or IIU. Ibrahim, you're going to be speaking to him.
Yeah, so the Minister of Finance, they want to do two things here to actually boost what they call Islamic economy. This is something very fresh out of the oven because everybody was talking about Islamic finance for the longest of time. Right now, they want to talk about Islamic economy, which is apparently a larger ecosystem than Islamic finance. Islamic finance would form a subset of Islamic economy. So the MOF wants to use Wakaf to strengthen and boost the Islamic economy. And Wakaf, not many people know this, not just non-Muslims, but Muslims as well. Essentially, we're going to unearth what was the mechanism that the MOF was thinking in terms of managing the property and the endowment fund under the concept of charity.
Perhaps. So what is Wakaf?
So Wakaf essentially means the management of property that is being given away by a donor. So I have...
But in like a public trust sort of...
It is a public trust. The direct translation is endowment fund. And the question is, would laws in Malaysia permit it? And what about properties overseas where, you know, Islamic law has no bearing in these kind of markets? So that is one way of managing assets and whether or not it's a more effective way than what we do today. The second thing is that Malaysia wants to launch the world's first Islamic venture capital fund. So I'm going to be asking Prof. Aslam Hanif whether or not this is going to be beneficial to those that actually put money inside this fund. Because what's wrong with the funds that we have today? Again, just because you slap on the Sharia connotation on it.
Oh, the Sharia
the
brand.
Labeling,
yeah.
The label on it.
Right,
does it mean that it's going to perform any better or worse than the additional fund? Again, you can also invest in common funds that are Sharia compliant that do not need this particular tag of Islamic VC or Islamic Venture Capital Fund. So those are the two big challenges that we can actually ask Prof. Aslam Hanif later.
I guess the difference between Islamic finance and Islamic economy is that finance deal with everything that's financial, whereas the economy is much wider. You know, the halal industry, the food industry, the travel, medical care, healthcare, and so
Absolutely.
On.
Absolutely, you're dead on. Yes.
Do you think this would raise the degree of polarization, not only in Malaysia but in the world?
Yeah, for me, in my personal opinion, absolutely. It does. Raise that kind of polarization, or at least brings us to this is how we do things and versus this is how you do things. And I think this might not help at the end of the day in terms of integration. But
the solution is not to not have all these products, right? So what would the solution be?
Absolutely. This is a question that I would like to ask Prof. Aslam as well, because he's a big proponent of this thing called Islamic economy, right? You know, this is a story where I spoke to my relative of mine. He's a Malaysian, he's a Malay Singaporean. And his, what do you call that? GRC, right?
Group representative constituency.
Absolutely. So he appealed for a halal market at his particular constituency. And he was turned down. The MPs of his area basically said that the moment we allow for a halal market, we then have to allow for you know, some other, like a Christian market, like a Buddhist market, and we cannot allow that to happen. Everything is about integration.
Halal market presumably would allow Jewish people to come there as well. I mean, anybody who wants kosher food would be able to access a halal market.
That was the official government stance of Singapore's rejection of the creation of a halal market, like a wet market. I don't know whether that is the best kind of argument, but it does negate that whole polarization argument.
I think that if you go by free market, right, you are allowed to set up anything you want to set up. But the moment you ask the government to give some kind of endorsement, then such governments as the Singapore government is would have to consider it from the wider angle of what people want. As far as Malaysia is concerned, it so happens that the government here is more Islamic, so they would be on the side of endorsing these proposals.
Yeah, so plenty of issues to talk about.
Yeah.
It's not just about the Islamic economy per se, but national unity as well, yeah.
Okay, on current affairs, which comes after the Breakfast Grill and the 8:30 news, it is a look at mental health, and apparently the Ministry of Health has announced a 5-year strategic action plan to address many of the mental health issues that have emerged, especially among young people ages 16 to 24, where mental health issues are now on the rise. And I wonder if it's got to do with increasing awareness that, you know, problems are of a mental health nature, as opposed to personality, as opposed to spirit possession, which, you know, in a previous era, that might be the prognosis, mm-hmm. right? Or the diagnosis is
I don't think it belongs in another era. I think it still is until today.
I was just about to say that.
Well, yes, maybe on balance, there are more people today who will be diagnosed by their friends and family and peers or whatever as having a mental health problem rather than being possessed by the devil. But you're right. I mean, retreat to that kind of argument, like that, you know, somebody's mental health problem is in fact about, you know, being possessed or having some sort of demonic dimension. It's probably still there. Unfortunately, it remains very, very much part of the way which people deal with the world, right?
Absolutely.
So on current affairs at 8:35 or so, we're going to be looking at mental health. Also today, on Pressing Matters, which happens at 9:30, we have BFM's Uma Pagadambika Pakin speaking to a man who led the National Public Radio system for many years, and he was also a former foreign correspondent, John Dingus. So you're going to have that interview at 9:30. Now, quick look at the news. We can, U.S. presidential, well, I don't know if it's a presidential race anymore. It's a presidential spectacle, a global presidential spectacle. And one of the chief protagonists of it is Donald Trump's mouth. You know, not always attached to his brain. But there you have it. President Obama, outgoing U.S. president, has kind of characterized Donald Trump's vulgar comments on women as a symptom of insecurity.
I think you could say that this is one of the biggest sabotage that a candidate has exacted on his own campaign, mm-hmm. right? I mean, the least you could do is to show some willingness to protect your own campaign. But here you are. Obviously, this...
he's apologized, hasn't he?
He has, and he was saying that this is just male locker room banter, and that's his apology. But, you know, to be fair to him, this was a video that originated from 10 years ago, but it's just come to haunt him today only because of all his antics in the current race. And, you know, there is an article in The New Yorker saying that with a headline, Republican Party could recover as early as 2096. Mm-hmm. That's the extent of the kind of support the Republican Party is going through. Even his own colleagues within that party are now abandoning him. I don't know how he could win this election, and be very interesting to see the debate, the second debate that will be coming up in a few days' time.
Actually, I think it's today.
Is it today?
Yeah,
okay.
It's today. I think 9 or 10 a.m. our time.
That'd be so interesting to watch.
I don't know. I'm scared, actually, for because it's live television. He can say anything he wants. Well, I don't know whether these news stations have these bleepers or you know.
Well, you know, this is the thing, right? What you want these shows to do is to tell you a little bit about the candidates. Demeanor, their personality, all mental health status, right? I mean, apart from the kind of arguments they make on a policy level, you just want to see them under pressure and how they react. And Donald Trump's insecurities are longstanding, right? I remember the early part of the Republican primaries, you know, he talked about his appendage and he was like, you know, and he was like, mostly
and his
about
hands.
His hands and his appendage. And I was like, my God, this is a classy dude.
Yeah. No, I think his biggest crime is that he went into the first debate not having been prepared and winging the whole thing and really did not give any respect whatsoever to the seriousness of the situation.
So, Jules, I just want to add to the point that I read an article on Vox.com to show how he is preparing for this round of debates because it's not like the last round where it was a two-on-one. It's a moderator versus two candidates. It's actually a town hall session, this type the debate.
So it comes
format.
From the audience?
Absolutely, from the floor, actually. And I don't know whether he will just have a meltdown here.
Well, you know, and we mustn't forget there's also this other person, Hillary Clinton. I mean, because
Who is she again?
She's the nominee for the Democratic Party.
You haven't been living under a rock.
Yeah, I mean, you know, she herself has a lot of problems, but perhaps completely eclipsed by Donald Trump at this
Absolutely.
Point in time.
I think she has handled the situation very well. She just allowed Donald Trump to do his thing.
To kind of be...
To stay ahead, right? Just you know, keeping quiet. I mean, over the whole weekend fiasco, she hasn't said a thing. So she's maintained that kind of elegant silence.
Yeah, I mean, no, what I mean is she's also got her own problems. And I think WikiLeaks has produced more emails and stuff. So, but like, again... Donald Trump has eclipsed all in that field. We'll be back very soon. BFM 89.9. You're listening to The Morning Run and our curious choice of music. You just heard Dedicated Flower.
Sorry, like
Dedicated, sorry, Follower of Fashion by The Kinks. We're clearly not driven by contemporary music fashions. We're kind of really alternative, aren't we, in our musical chase?
I think we shouldn't go into this debate of music genres between you, the three of us.
Yeah.
Me being completely illiterate about music. Was Julian Ng, by the way, and Ibrahim Sani is also in the room, and myself, Sharad Kutin. And it's 21 minutes past 6 on the 10th of October. We've just sent out a tweet, and it's a poll on mental health. And the question is, would you spend money and time to deal with your psychological issues? And what we mean is, would you go to a mental health professional to deal with them? So far, we've got 57% yes, with no hesitation, 29% yes, but I would hesitate, and 14% saying no, I would not go. I fear the stigma of going to a mental health professional. So interesting, I think, balance of opinions, right? People are being honest about their fear of the stigma.
So this is, of course, part of our World Mental Health Day story. We have that show on Current Affairs this morning, a bit on mental health, and that's how it's connected with this poll, I suppose.
Yeah, and, you know, our earlier discussion about this. I mean, this is an issue for every day, and you know, and you hear, in fact, on a daily basis, you know, friends or family or people related who have issues, and the question is whether they constitute mental health issues. Interesting in the way in which people cope with the stresses of daily life. In America, apparently, you can hire a professional cuddler. When I mean cuddler, I mean person who will cuddle you. And there's something quite primal in this because I guess many of us will associate cuddling with childhood, with being young and being a young person or a baby or a child and how your parents deal with it, how they touch you, you know, how they, you know, deal with you on a very physical level.
Mm-hmm.
What do you associate with the word cuddle, Julian?
Keeping
this on the classy side.
The same things as you, Sharad. But I think that this, when it's done professionally and commercially, it has got elements of slipping into, you know, the dodgier side of things. Because when you pay, I guess, for a cuddle, you might want more things than a cuddle.
This is true, but let's assume that if you wanted more things, you could just go for the morethings.com site rather than go to the cuddlelist.com, right?
I'm sure they would have a set of rules about what you can or cannot do.
Okay, so both of you are dead on in this because I watched a video on YouTube. I'll share the link shortly. And it's about the story of a professional cuddler in the Bronx, in New York. And they were covering the story of how people who seek out cuddling literally want cuddles. They don't want the, you know, want morethings.com. They don't want that because you can actually get that everywhere else, right? What they need is that set of rules that you speak of, Julian. There's a standard of conduct. There's a minimum level of requirement of service provided for or called for by the professional cuddler. And everything is above board. And the video covers the story of how he interacts with his so-called clients, right? And he does it at his house. There's, you know, everything.
It's a man.
It's a man. Yeah. It's a man. And I think in that video, he was saying that he prefers almost exclusively female clients. And he's more of the effeminate, you know, spectrum of a man. And he... You know, it's not just about cuddling. It's about the comfort that he gives to his clients. They talk a lot. And he has that one line that I will never forget from watching that video. He says, "I attempt to be my client's best friend because that's what they pay me for them to be, you know, well-loved and for them to just have a chat." Now, the professional cuddling world.
Okay, I want to ask the both of you about your growing up. Did you come from families that were very demonstrative physically, that in fact did a lot of cuddling, did a lot of hugging, you know, kissing, the kind of and touching in the way that, you know, we associate with families and children? Julian, did you have that as a child?
Well, the one big demonstration that I can remember from a family is the rod, right, a cane. And that
kind
was...
of demonstrative. I'm not thinking but about that. I'm thinking about that other type.
Yeah, I've had my fair share.
Because some families are not, right? I mean, I know of people who don't come from families that are demonstrative physically in this way. I mean, they might be loving and respectful, but they don't show it by touching in quite that way.
I think it's unavoidable for a lot of people. If you don't get it from your family, you get it from friends, you get it from partners.
Yeah, that's true. But yeah. That's what I'm talking about is that foundational experience of touch and being demonstrative. If you didn't come and grow up in a family that was demonstrative in that way, you might not actually become, a demonstrative parent yourself, right? You might feel that... And sometimes
you might make up for lost time.
So this is a good point, right? Because I don't know how much of that formative years that you bring towards your adult life, because I was reading this particular article which says that if you were an abusive, you come from an abusive family, right? You're beaten up, you know, you have a very nasty dad, for instance, right? The chances of you becoming an abusive person is about the same as a person that doesn't come from that kind of family or household.
Oh, yeah. Really? Yeah. I would have thought that some level of modeling, meaning that your idea of what a family is and proper relationships and is modeled on your own family.
But there is that repulsion as well towards something. If you feel that you've experienced something that's quite unpleasant, most likely you wouldn't want to duplicate that experience for your children. So if you went through a family that was demonstrative, as you put it, Sharad, you probably want to replicate that, but not if it was the other way around, not if it was abusive, then you might not want to unleash that on your children.
Yeah, absolutely. I can understand that. So to answer your question, Sharad, I did come from a family that were very, you know, expressive. My mother did touch us a lot, did cuddle us a lot when we were kids, right? But at the same time, she was very stern, right? I mean, her standards, right? Today, I think she would have been arrested for
what she did. Yeah, okay, the difference is. But the point is, they're not actually mutually exclusive, because parents who cuddle and hug you and kiss you can also use the cane, and perhaps they will cuddle you while you cry after they've caned you.
Yeah.
Yeah, and but I think that just going back to this article and just making reference to the World Mental Health Day, this is important for a lot of people. They need this human touch because for a variety of reasons, right? They're lonely, they're not getting that level of love from the family or friends, and perhaps these are the very people where this kind of therapy is even perhaps better than normal medical therapy that we find.
Right. So, okay. So, there's a reassurance that somebody can give you verbally, but there is something, there's another dimension when somebody hugs you, right? So, in fact, sometimes you don't even need to have the words said, but the hug itself demonstrates it. In fact, we were talking about this before we came back on air about the hormone related to touch, which is oxytocin, is it?
Yeah, oxytocin, yeah.
And what does that do again?
It really is the kind of hormone that exists the moment you're born that creates the bond between you and your mother. Mm. And so it's a feeling of, I guess, trust. Is a trust hormone.
It's a trust hormone. So that's interesting. So there's actually something deeply physiological in touch as well. It's not just about the idea of hugging. It is the actual touch, that tactile sensation that releases certain hormones and, you know, floods you with well-being or, in this case, trust in another human being, right?
So in fact, they're using this, they want to use this commercially to have you trust your product provider.
Well, you mean like take a pill before you buy
something? Well, I'll spray some fragrances into the air or something.
Well, okay. Oh, we're coming up to the bulletin right now, and we have Nadia Abdul Aziz. Stay tuned on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run. That was Bold as Love by the Jimi Hendrix Experience. Which is different from Jimi Hendrix, isn't it? It's a kind of a band, I guess. Jimi Hendrix, a three-man band. Jimi Hendrix, of course, died young. I don't believe he committed suicide, but he just had an overdose, was it?
He's one of those 27-year-old musicians that died. Him, you know, Kurt Cobain.
Janis Joplin.
Whatever, the lot of them. So,
right,
yeah.
Maybe in the 60s, in particular, you know, psychedelic drugs was a way of coping with stress and mental health issues, aren't they?
I just want to slip this in, right? Because there's a podcast.
Oh, by the way, that's Ibrahim Sani.
Yes.
Julian Ng is here, and I'm Sharad Kutin, and it's 6:40 on the 10th of October.
Right. So thanks for that, Sharad. I'm now actually listening to a new show called Science Versus on Gimlet Media, and it's also being aired at npr.com. And one of the older episodes talks about this whole why do these famous musicians die at 27? And inconclusive evidence based on science, of course, at the end of the show. But essentially, they're saying they have access to capital, meaning that they're rich. What they argue, it's a postulation, there's no scientific proof to this, is that by the time, because you gain all these popularity early on in your 20s, and by 25 or 26, you're not accustomed to this kind of fame, depression sets in. And at 27, you get access to loads and loads of drugs and all the other, you know, big naughty things that you can get your hands on, and that's why you pass away at 27. That's the story there.
Okay, so is there kind of a secret wish, do you think, on the part of those famous people to kind of end it all? You know, end on a high note, or you know, or something like that. Do you think there's a death wish involved in suicide?
I
don't know. I think that a lot of rich people also have this. They're adrenaline junkies, right? They go for some of the more risky activities and put their lives at risk. I mean, they do that for cakes. Because they have the money to do so.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, of course, we're bringing this up because not because it's Monday.
But because it's World Mental Health Day, and we actually have a poll. People have weighed in. And interesting, because the question we answered, would you spend money and time to deal with your psychological issues if you go to a mental health professional? The numbers of people saying, the percentage of people saying they would without hesitation has dropped to 38%. Many more, 50% said they would, but they would hesitate. And some 12 say absolutely no because they fear the stigma. I think that's quite revealing. I mean, even in our small poll, it's only about 24 people at this point in time. But you know, I can understand why people would hesitate because they're not sure of its efficacy. You know, they were also used to drugs, but you say, well, would you pay 200 ringgit an hour to sit with somebody to talk about your problems or 100 ringgit, whatever it is?
There's also that societal stigma, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't want to go and seek help for the kind of shame and embarrassment they think they might get out of it.
Yeah, but you know, you're generally in a situation where if you have a good professional, you don't encounter the other patients either.
Yeah.
You come at a time when you're just there with the person. And if you have, again, a very professional person dealing with you, they won't even really acknowledge you in public. You know, they keep their distance. And the idea is you don't want to kind of have a friend or, you know, in this person. You're going there because they're providing you a service. Mm-hmm. And it can be very and all these safeguards are put in place for you.
It's worth noting that you know, you don't need to have money to get treatment. Government hospitals, particularly the big ones, in and around the big cities. UH is excellent. Sungai Buloh, HKL is one of the biggest you know, psychiatric clinics there is in KL. You can actually get professional help and mental help with little to minimal cost.
Yeah, you know, my aunt, when I was growing up in Johor Bahru, was a psychiatrist at Tampoi, because Tampoi is actually the name of a place, but it became the, you know, like Tanjung Rambutan became kind of synonymous with
the word of its own.
Yeah, that's right. You know? And so she was there, you know, dealing with all these people. So many years, I kind of grew up knowing that people had mental health issues, you know, and that those needed to be dealt with. And then, of course, later on in life, I encountered them. And, you know, and it's both family and friends who've had serious problems. And they've, you know, some of them not succeeded in overcoming them. You know, I had a cousin who killed herself. And I think it's really sad that some people don't get the help and the intervention when it's necessary to prevent them from doing something like suicide.
But, you know, sometimes societal pressures are so strong, work pressures are so strong. I mean, there was this news from 2 days ago that a young employee from Dentsu killed herself because of overwork. The Japanese, in fact, have a word for it. It's called death by overwork. It's called karoshi. So they have a word to represent the situation. And this person, this young lady of 24, killed herself after it was found that she logged around 105 monthly hours of overtime. Now, if you divide 105 hours by, let's say, 20 working days, that's an extra 5 hours of working per day. But if you assume she worked every day, that's 3 extra hours every day. And you can understand how this kind of thing can drive people to craziness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, it just, there are, I guess, situations where there's a lot of pressure, there are expectations. I understand that even some professions are associated with mental health.
But this is, so this karoshi, the word that the Japanese describes death by overwork, of course, she took her own life. There are, you know, instances. Remember, there was an intern that passed away in a JP Morgan bank or one of those big.
Yeah, quite a number of banks.
Yeah. So, you know, it's directly correlatable, if that's such a word for it, or
relatable. Directly correlated.
Correlated. There you go. Thanks, guys. Where mental health is directly associated with work. And it's not just about the work that you do. It's the amount of time that you spend doing it. And I think a lot of mental health professionals, psychiatrists, counselors, and so on, they always ask, what is your relationship with your coworkers? What's the relationship with you at work? Because essentially that contributes a lot of your waking hours, right? You don't spend as much time with your family, for instance, as you do at work. And I think choosing the right job is crucial for maintaining a healthy mental health.
Well, okay. So mental health, we put out a poll. Just remember, do weigh in and give us also your explanations. Tell us if you hesitate or you feel there is a stigma. You know, where did the stigma arise from? So tell us, the question we put to you is, would you spend money and time to deal with your psychological issues? You got yes, no hesitation, yes, but I would hesitate, no, I fear the stigma. So these are all the options available. Now it's about 39% for yes, no hesitation, 46% leading the pack with yes, I would hesitate, and 15% saying no, they fear the stigma.
Now, of course, there's another story. Just to end the note on a high you know, high point rather than start the Monday with
an inspirational note.
Yes. There's this story by Time.com that talks about the 10 creative geniuses who had to fail to succeed. And if you look at the list, right, many of them actually had to combat their own, you know, inner demons and overcome their own mental health issues. And I think it's important for us to actually learn or take the lessons from these individuals who actually initially had to fail, but essentially found success at the end of the day.
Yeah, well, you know, talking about inner demons, you could watch the television series Penny Dreadful, and those characters in it actually have inner demons. I mean, literally, like coming out of their stomach.
Beautiful TV series.
Yeah. Vanessa Ives, you know, pale and Ravenhead.
Some of these people mentioned in the Time article, J.K. Rowling, Vincent Van Gogh, Lady Gaga, Dr. Seuss, Claude Monet, Ludwig van Beethoven, you know, and the list goes on, Jay-Z. So these people, their outward persona is that they're hugely megastars, very successful, right? But they had to go through hurdles to get to where they were, and they failed many times before they achieved success. And of course, we can define success in our own ways, right? We don't have to be megastars to have that labeled that as a success.
Yeah, and of course, some people have success posthumously. I think people like Vincent van Gogh. Only succeeded after they died, unfortunately, which is kind of like annoying, isn't it, to have success after you die?
Yeah, absolutely.
The whole point is to, in fact, have success.
Enjoy that
before,
whole thing.
Yeah.
I mean, think of the kind of art that he would have produced if he was successful while alive. It'd be very different.
Well, maybe you get co-opted and start drawing, you know, silly things like sunflowers and daffodils. Right. Who knows? Anyway, we've got news coming up at the top of the hour. But first, let's listen to Love Cats by The Cure on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.